Your name didn't come up there.
It doesn't show his name, so as hit star 5.
Okay.
I just need to, I'm going to look at something on here. I know it's him because he connected, but I listened to the little, that little play button that's next to the name. That tells me what their recorded name is, because then we have everybody prompting to put their names in when they call.
Oh, okay.
So that I have to listen to it, and then I'm able to call them.
Oh, all right. Then, after John's done talking, we'll see if we've got a whole bunch of questions there. If we do, then we'll let you take over.
Yeah.
And then just remind people they have to press star 5.
Did you hit star 5? It didn't come up. Hit it again. Definitely star 5. We did it a billion times already.
You want me to call in?
Oh, there we go.
Oh, it cannot.
It's because I still have my whole.
Oh. But this doesn't actually. So I have to look at the wireless caller number and then go here. Okay, that's fine. So we have a question from Connor Wren. Go ahead, Connor. I think it's your cell phone. Okay. Done. Yeah.
John? John Zerlo?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, hey, how are you? This is Peter.
Hi, is this Peter?
Yep.
Hi, Peter.
Hi. We'll get started in just about a minute, John. We've got quite a list of people here that are joining the call.
Yep.
All right, everybody, welcome to this phone call, conference call. My name's Peter Havens. I'm the chairman of Baldwin Management, and we're very pleased to have today Dr. John J. Zerlow, who is a W. Paul and Ida H. Havens Professor in Infectious Diseases and also the Division Director of Infectious Diseases at Jefferson University in Philadelphia. Before John starts speaking, I just want to remind everybody that we are now in presentation mode, which means essentially only John will be speaking, and all of you, the rest of you, are on mute. And then there will be a question and answer period after John's finished his discussion, about 15, 20 minutes, so you can answer your questions. We anticipate the call going for about an hour length in time. It's all subject to John's availability because, as you might suspect right now, he's very much in demand in the city of Philadelphia. So without further ado, let me turn it over to John Zerlow. And, John, go ahead.
All right. Well, good afternoon, I presume, but it may be different time zones for people. But so here we are in Philadelphia at 4 p.m. So needless to say, both I here at Jefferson, and it's safe to say that every infection control and infectious diseases physician in the country and perhaps in the world is struggling with all the same issues that we are. So we're really trying to develop policies, develop rapid testing, and prepare for what could be a surge of individuals, of patients with this infection. So maybe I should start off by saying, I'll give you kind of a clinical update. As you probably have read in the papers, this virus probably originated in China from one of these fresh meat or live meat markets that they sell seafood and live animals. And probably the first cases were transmitted in, say, October-November range. The index case was December 1st, and the Chinese government, after realizing there was something going on here, announced that the epidemic reports began on December 31st in 2019. And really, within the next 3 weeks, they had already published papers on the clinical features of the disease, which frankly haven't changed very much since then, as well as, you know, isolating the virus, I mean, in a very, very specific way, so we understand what the virus is and so forth. As probably people know, the clinical features of this infection include, unfortunately, symptoms that are very common to respiratory illnesses, which include fever, cough, and when people get sick with it, they develop shortness of breath. And this seems to be the problem when people develop something beyond an upper respiratory infection, and they get sick in the sense of they develop pneumonia, and then once pneumonia ensues, there can be lots of other complications, including overall sepsis and so forth, that lead to some of these people not surviving from this infection. It, just as a general number, roughly 80 to 85% of people who develop this infection get just a bad cold, not even a bad cold sometimes. We think most people who develop the infection do have symptoms, but they could be very minor. There have been cases of people who have been without symptoms who probably have been able to spread infection. The WHO thinks those numbers are probably pretty small. So the good thing is most people who are infectious are symptomatic. But that's the challenge, because there's really nothing distinguishing, especially in somebody who has these mild symptoms. There's nothing that would distinguish this from the common cold or the influenza that's still rampant, still widespread, certainly in the United States, and probably still lots of places in the Northern Hemisphere. So that's the challenge. So 80 to 85% of people develop this, they get over it, and they move on with their lives, which means that 15 to 20% of people get quite sick from it. often requiring hospitalization. In fact, typically requiring hospitalization. And as probably everyone has seen also, those most likely to develop severe illness are people who are older. It's hard to come up with a precise cutoff, but I think the CDC and others say around 60 when there's sort of a sharper inflection point, but it really goes up in 70 and 80 and above. In addition, however, there are also other mitigating medical issues, and there's a lot of medical illnesses that seem to make people more predisposed. Cardiovascular disease, COPD, diabetes, oddly enough, hypertension as a specific thing. And we think things like cancer and people who are immunosuppressed because of medications or immunosuppressed with cancers and that kind of thing, they're probably more susceptible to developing severe disease, and they're the kind of the highest risk. We've seen this, of course, spread first from China and then to other Asian countries. Korea has, of course, been the other hotbed of infection. Of course, there was spread then to Europe, most notably Italy and Iran in the Middle East. I think as a general statement, now that we've learned some of these lessons of what's happened in some of these countries, everyone is trying to emulate the Korean model and perhaps the Chinese model rather than the Italian model. I think the Italians really got caught off guard with this. In Italy, for example, well, if we look just at mortality, right now the World Health Organization is suggesting that roughly 3%, they expect 3% mortality from this infection. Just to compare that to seasonal flu, which everyone probably, I mean, I would guess almost everybody on the call has become experts now in knowing these numbers. But remember, seasonal flu, we think that the mortality is probably about 0.1%, 0.1%. With that still the case, since there are so many millions of cases of influenza, you know, so far this year, we would have expected that far more people have expired from influenza than they will this infection so far, but the rate is the concern. It's a much higher rate. Now, with that said, the Italian mortality rate as of today is roughly 7%. That's pretty worrisome. Of course, the Italian patients who have gotten it, a lot of them were much older. Compared with the Korean exposure, again, everyone, I think, is trying to emulate the Korean model of approaching this. The Korean death rate is more like 1%. And if I'm not mistaken, they were set to brief health authorities worldwide today or tomorrow. I think it's today, actually, from the World Health Organization, the CDC, and so forth, and describe how they were able to keep their numbers lower and keep their death rate lower. So that's somewhat encouraging. Right now in the United States, as of this moment, there are approximately 4,300 individuals infected, of whom 75 have so far died. So that's just that very rough number. It's about a 1.7% mortality. Now, the United States has been very slow to get up with testing, unfortunately. The number of tests, you know, if you look at, let me see if I thought I had that number handy, but we've tested relatively few, and therefore we're quite sure that the numbers are much higher of numbers of infection in the United States. And obviously the whole country has gone from zero to about a million in about 4 or 5 days with terms of self-quarantining and so forth, and so that's I think under the circumstances a good thing. I think the kinds of self-quarantining and avoiding large numbers or avoiding large crowds and so forth is bound to mitigate the effects of this, and we won't know that, I think, for probably at least 3 to 4 weeks, because remember, all of these measures went into effect rather suddenly within the last few days. Now, we still haven't caught up with the actually listening tests, much less those that have been performed, getting their results back. And so what we're going to see over the next certainly couple of weeks is we're going to see this massive increase in the numbers of new diagnoses as all these test results come back. Once again, I'm not sure why the U.S. was so slow to getting testing up and going. There's still quite a bit of a two bottlenecks right now. One is actually setting up testing sites to get people's samples sent. And the second bottleneck is actually the time it takes to get the test results back. You know, right now it's taking 3 to 5 days to get the test results back, and that's really quite a challenge. We and other sites throughout the country now are ramping up. I'm hoping within the next 2 weeks to have much wider availability of tests. We expect at Jefferson, for example, to introduce testing through this so-called Roche testing kit, which we have the machines, and these are widely available, that we hope to be able to run as many as 1,200 tests per day and get the results back within 4 hours. And that's important to both rule in patients for the sake of isolation and quarantining, and hopefully rule out patients. Remember, people can be presenting with lots of different types of infections that masquerade as COVID. So that's the challenge. So we'll see. Again, I predict that the numbers will go up rather dramatically in the next few weeks, and we hope to see those numbers then start to ameliorate. I'm thinking over the next 4 weeks or so, not sure right now. The CDC has recommended this kind of quarantining to go on. Right now they're saying around 8 weeks, so that's a long time. And just in your own personal experiences, certainly mine in Philadelphia, I'm seeing that the streets were kind of empty this morning when I walked to work. So this is really likely to change things in the United States over the next several weeks for sure. In terms of treatment and vaccination, right now there are no proven treatments for COVID. Everyone's probably read a bit about this drug called remdesivir, which was originally created as an anti-Ebola drug by Gilead Pharmaceuticals. Now, Gilead has already tested this in vitro, and we know it has activity against some of these coronaviruses, including the original SARS virus. And so right now, there are multiple trials that are ongoing, both in the United States as well as in China and maybe other countries, looking to determine efficacy of this drug. And the drug is now being made available by Gilead for compassionate use. So if we have a patient here in the hospital who's quite ill, we can apply and get a single use of remdesivir. Exactly whether it truly works or not remains to be seen. I think the challenge for this drug, let's say it is effective, if you think about a drug like Tamiflu or oseltamivir to treat influenza, of course we know people can get very sick with influenza, but we believe that, and in fact the way it's prescribed right now is we want to get this drug started, Tamiflu, in a flu case within 48 hours of symptoms, because we know that by doing that we can effectively mitigate both the illness, influenza, in these individuals and certainly drop the viral load and therefore make the patient less infectious very quickly. So if the same is true, and I would have to believe that's going to be the case, probably the people you want to treat with remdesivir are those who we catch early and hope to reduce the chances that they'll get the severe complications from it. But obviously right now that's not going to be possible. Once again, we don't even know that it works. There are some other drugs that are kind of off the shelf that may have some or may have some activity. We are suggesting using an anti-malarial drug, chloroquine, or as many may have read in the papers, its cousin hydroxychloroquine that is used for a variety of autoimmune illnesses, we have really just in vitro and preliminary data that it might be of some value, but that's very much disputed in my community as to whether it has any role. We'll recommend it because, quite frankly, unless we can get remdesivir, we won't have much else to recommend for patients very ill with this infection. Whether it really has any benefit, I don't know. The Chinese have a drug that I can't even remember, the Havilovir or something like that, that they are using, but that's not available in the United States, and I don't know that anyone has any data about its effectiveness. As people have heard through, among others, Dr. Fauci and other who have familiar with these kinds of outbreaks, it's unlikely that we're to have a vaccine that's of any value or any efficacy, you know, at least for a year. Remember, in vaccine development, first you have to develop a vaccine that theoretically targets the right things that you want it to target, so specific surface proteins that would induce an immune response. So once you've decided that, then you manufacture the vaccine, and then you have to first do safety testing. Then you have to do dose testing to determine what's the optimal dose that will generate at least a theoretical immune response. So once you've gone through all of those steps, then you have to bring it into clinical trials. And of course, as an epidemic changes, you know, the more cases that you have that are active, then the more likely you're quickly going to determine efficacy of a vaccine. If, let's say, we go into the summer months and the numbers of cases decline, then the fewer cases you have, it just takes a longer time to determine whether a vaccine is efficacious. You need the disease in order to determine whether a vaccine is effective. So those are many of the vagaries of getting together a vaccination for this. Happily, there's a lot of people working on this right now, so we'll have to see how that goes. I think that's probably the best medical summary that I can give of COVID as to where we stand right now. Once again, everyone everywhere in this country is scrambling. You know, I want to give some hope to the audience, which is that I think that the quarantining that we've quickly gotten to in this country will probably have some effect in mitigating the spread of this. I'm hoping that that there's something perhaps advantageous about American medical system, about our population, that will make this a little less deadly than it has been in certain parts of the country. As I said, we're trying to emulate Korea's model rather than Italy's model, and obviously that's an ongoing disaster in many ways in Italy. Those are probably all my comments, so I don't know how you want to, Peter, if you want to take it from here as to questions, or how do you want to proceed?
Sure. Well, while people are lining up, remember, if you want to ask a question, hit *5, and we'll see your hand being raised, and then we'll call on you. But let me start off the questions, if I might. John, I've seen from several sources a number of 200,000 people that might require intensive care. And I guess what I'm wondering about is, in China, now you may not exactly believe their numbers, but let's say there were 80,000 people infected in China and a subset of those people died. But I wouldn't think that anybody would consider China to be first world medicine, certainly improved from the old days, but not first world. Certainly doesn't compare to the healthcare system we've got in this country. So why are people talking about, well, we in a moderate pandemic, if you will, in this country, we could have 200,000 people who are afflicted with this and in the ICU, thus overwhelming our hospital systems. Is that an accurate number? What's the disconnect between the Chinese experience and what people are talking about?
I think it's, you know, Peter, if you've seen these mathematical models, they can look very scary, and they are mathematical models, and I appreciate, you know, the assumptions. Every mathematical model is dependent upon the assumptions you put in. So those are certainly the worst-case scenarios, and I've seen those statistics, and I don't know. I mean, I think obviously that would be a complete disaster, and so I don't know how to comment on that, honestly. It sounds a bit excessive to me, quite frankly, maybe a little bit more than a bit.
Okay, thank you.
I wish I had a better answer to that. I'm not an epidemiologist by trade, but I understand how these models are set up, and so it seems like a worst-case scenario by far. I'm looking.
All right,
the only comment I'd say is from the Italian experience, they really got caught flat-footed, and they do. It's a more modern healthcare system than China. I just don't think they were prepared for this in the same way that we are at this point. I think we've learned something from them, which is, boy, you got to do this quarantining pretty early. But I understand that the Italians have, I don't know that I've read this for sure, as many or more beds per capita, hospital beds per capita as the United States, but perhaps fewer respirators than the United States on a per capita basis. I think perhaps the other things I would caution are, remember, the Chinese, they have an authoritarian government, and they've done some very drastic things, as you've seen, and they have a capability of, you know, putting a hospital together, like, in 2 days. I mean, it's just crazy efficient that they can do all of this. They have some advantages in this kind of authoritarian system that gives them some advantages. So they were able to quell the epidemic. In addition, and if you look at South Korea, it's a much smaller place. This is the challenge in that this outbreak is occurring through a large country like ours, or whatever the number is, 350 million people. So I can understand why these assumptions could be built into a model that would, you know, lead to these kinds of numbers, but I still think it seems excessive to me.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Our next question is from Elaine Smith.
Hi, I am 70 years old and want to know what factors you would take into account to decide whether or not to travel in the summer months, which would involve air.
Here's my take. Right now, I wouldn't plan any travel. I wouldn't schedule any flights right now. This is my own view. Certainly for the next 4 to 8 weeks, I wouldn't plan anything. And we just have to see how this plays out. That's my take.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. Our next question is from Rich Lawrence.
Yes, hi. Doctor, could I imply from your comment regarding travel that the seasonality of this virus may not be like influenza? Is there any evidence that seasonality is a factor, or a bit too early to take those assumptions?
Too early to tell. I don't know, actually. We'd love to see that, gee, as the warm months come in, then this will tail off. Remember, the H1N1 developed, that was back in 2009, really developed during the summer months. That's a little weird. That's a little unusual. But remember, you know, here's the funny thing in infectious disease. We don't know why respiratory viruses occur more in the winter months. We have a lot of theories about it. Yeah, everybody's cramped up. The air is drier, all that kind of stuff. We don't really know for sure why that's the case, and therefore it makes it difficult to predict and say, yeah, it's a warm month come and this thing is just going to naturally tail off. We don't know.
Great. Thank you.
Yep.
If anybody else has a question, you can hit *5 on your phone, and you'll be added into the queue here.
Okay, well, while there's a lull in the action, John, let me jump back in.
Yep.
There was a fellow fairly high up in the Chinese Ministry of Health. He was, in fact, he was the guy who was in charge of their battle against SARS. So he's, I think, fairly highly regarded within the medical community. And he's posited that he believes that if people pay attention to this, that the pandemic could be over by June. What do you think?
I could say that's possible. That's possible. It'll be interesting to see what happens now with Europe and the United States ramping up this quarantining and such to reduce the spread of this. So it's possible. I'm an optimist, so I can't say I think so, but I think that's certainly a reasonable scenario.
Okay. Our next question is from Daniel Person. Are you there?
Hi. Yep, I'm here. Hey, as someone who kind of, you know, I've thought about these things in the past and planned ahead pretty well, and I'm basically more or less able to stay in my house for the next 6 months if I have to, what can I do as someone who I'm already prepared to help other people, so to speak, if that's as simple as just stay out of the way and that's the best I can do, but just for people who have no reason to worry about much personally and I can stay inside, what do I do to help?
To help others, huh? You know, I it's a great question, and I'm not sure if I have a good answer to you right now. You know, I appreciate your offer of benevolence, and if I could say, gee, you should go and volunteer here or do something like that, I think not. So I guess I'd have to say right now I'm not sure if I can give you any good guidance about that beyond.
Yeah, to be clear, I'm planning on just staying inside indefinitely.
Yeah, and of course,
but
that's what we all do.
That is my help, is just stay out of the way. And I just wanted to put that out there in case there was anything extra.
Yeah, I think so. I can't think of anything I would recommend for you.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, John, I've got another question for you. You mentioned Gilead's trials that are going on, and Moderna has just started inoculations in a phase one trial for their runner in this race. Do you think the regulators, though, because this obviously has caught everybody's attention in this country, if not around the world, do you think they might sort of try to expedite things, maybe shrink sizes of trials, maybe be satisfied with a phase 2A as opposed to requiring people go all the way to phase 3? What are your thoughts on that?
I would say, first of all, we have to make sure this doesn't make things worse. There are some theoretical reasons why some vaccines could actually make things worse. So, number one. Number two, vaccine safety is, like, super important, and therefore we have to test it in enough people to know that it's not causing trouble. Even if it, forget the infection part of it, but just that it's safe. Most vaccines, contrary to what some in the world believe, are quite safe. So I think safety is an important issue. Second is how quickly we can determine the laboratory values of efficacy and therefore translate that into a dosing recommendation. That's always the challenge as we move from phase one to phase two. As a other broad answer to your question, Peter, I think there's obviously enormous pressure to get a vaccine out there. And so I think from both the U.S. and world guidance, I think there's going to be every reason to want to both expedite the clinical trials and to analyze these very rapidly to determine statistical benefit of vaccine as well as the side effect profile and so forth. So does that mean we can get to this sooner than a year? I don't know. I wouldn't outthink my former mentor and friend Tony Fauci We were both graduates of the same high school in New York City, although he graduated several years ahead of me. I wouldn't want to outguess him and overstate. He thought at least a year. So, knowing full well of the urgency and so forth and so forth and so on. So maybe we can get to it sooner. I don't know.
Okay. Our next question is from Eric Ween.
Hello. I am a biochemist and have been interested in local preventative measures, hand washing versus the use of Purell. Of course, the commercial products are not available now. And so I decided I could take some isopropyl alcohol, add a little bit of
softening cream smoothing. Yeah.
And my question is, in your experience, is the isopropyl alcohol working by very different mechanisms? Is it as effective as hand washing or more effective? I realize if you're seeing patients, you have to be fast. You probably don't have time to wash your hands.
Yeah, I think that's the issue is that if you have time to wash your hands, hand washing is a great thing to do. Remember, it's in the hand washing business compared with things like the Purells and the isopropyls and stuff. With the hand washing, the rinsing action is really probably more important than anything else. Is your rinse? That's why they say 20 seconds and so forth. So I think hand washing is always going to be a great tool. If you happen to have hand sanitizer, whether it be commercial or you make your own concoction with isopropyl alcohol, which people are doing right now, add some softening cream and so forth. It should work. That's my take.
Yeah, so I understand. Either one. I'm actually a hand washer with alcohol
either one.
Backup.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right. If anybody else has any other questions, hit star 5.
Well, I'll jump back in, John, during the lull here. You mentioned a little bit earlier there emerged two schools of thought. One is massive testing, the Korean model, and I guess the other one is lockdown method, which would be, I guess, maybe the Chinese model. Which do you think makes the most sense?
I'm more towards the lockdown method because I think we just have to spread. I mean, we have to prevent the spread of this. With that said, we absolutely have to track the epidemic. A colleague of mine here suggests forget testing. Just don't do any testing. If you can't tell, just assume everybody's positive. We have to track the epidemic, and therefore we need to have the testing done. But I think in terms of actually truly mitigating this, I think the isolation stuff is going to be what really matters. If you had a disease that wasn't so common, that didn't masquerade as the common cold, and you can diagnose the case quickly and then isolate all those people around them, if it's something not quite as effective, for example, Ebola, then the testing is absolutely critical. But with this, I think the isolation is probably the most important.
Do you think Tony Fauci is going to recommend that the whole country, like Italy, go on a lockdown?
I don't know. The way it looks right now, we're largely in a lockdown. If it's sort of an enforced lockdown, that would be pretty hard to do in America. I think people seem to have a lot of motivation to stay indoors right now, and streets seem pretty quiet. I'm not going to say deserted here in Philadelphia. Certainly quieter than usual. And so I think a lockdown would be a pretty challenging exercise in the United States.
Okay, thanks.
Our next caller or our next question is coming from Chris.
Hi. Yeah, I have a small. Yes,
I'm an optometrist. I have a small business in Philadelphia, a couple of offices, and we've closed for the next 2 weeks. And I'm wondering how much longer, like if we've been hand-washing and keeping surfaces clean and doing everything we can, trying to screen patients before they come in, warning people, of course, if they have any symptoms, not to come in. When can I expect to have my staff come back to work, and how safe would it be if everybody maintains this type of procedure, which is hand-washing and cleaning, et cetera?
Maybe this is probably the most common question I'm asked, is about how long do we go along here? I've talked with a number of physicians with practices, and boy, that's a tough one. It really is a hard one. I think it seems fair to believe that things will get worse before they get better. And so if we're trying to judge that, say, a week and a half from now, and you have to decide what to do with the next 2 weeks, I don't think it's going to look any prettier, and therefore you're going to probably be stuck for a while, is my guess.
Okay. And what about since we've been open the last week and we've been and people have been coming in have been asymptomatic and seem okay, what are the chances that somebody's been possibly infected by one of them?
Well, once again, most people, we think, are in fact symptomatic. Problem is they could be minimally symptomatic. Maybe they just have a sore throat, a bit of a cough, and they come in conceivably they can be infectious. That's the challenge. That's why if the disease were clearly demarcatable, we can differentiate it in some clinical ground, then it would be easier to give that kind of guidance. So therein lies the challenge.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks, Chris. Our next question is from Jane.
Hi. I was reading some scientists in California done a preliminary work on this. They said that the virus stayed in the air for 3 hours live, and on the stainless steel that stayed like 3 days or something. Do you know anything more about that?
I know I see the same reports, and we're struggling with that right now because when people get hospitalized, we want to put them on the appropriate precautions. Most respiratory viruses, we believe, as you've been reading, I'm sure, they're spread by droplet transmission. So we presume that somebody coughs, somebody sneezes. If you're within 6 feet or so, that's what our guidance has always been, then these little droplets can then, you can inhale them, or they fall on a surface and they're still wet there, and therefore, you touch your hand and then you touch your face and so forth and so on. So that's the typical droplet. And if you think about what the kinds of isolation we put for most viruses, most respiratory viruses, somebody gets hospitalized, we put them on droplet isolation. That's true most certainly for influenza. With data like this about how the virus can sort of still be found and still be viable, whether that truly means or translates into that being an infectious circumstance, that's where we have a problem. We don't know that that's truly the case. And so it's very hard to give recommendations. And if it were that hardy, if the virus were that hardy, it would be obviously of grave concern. It affects us because when we hospitalize people, you've seen in Korea, they're putting on these hazmat suits. And once again, in a small country, in a small region that's affected, maybe you can do that. In a country as large as ours, with such a diverse hospital system and everything else, we're already in short supply of the kinds of masks, and especially masks, that would be required based on the initial guidance by the CDC, which means putting these so-called N95 masks or these positive assisted pressure respirators, PAPRs we call them, we put those on, plus goggles, plus gowns, plus gloves. Perhaps in a perfect world, we would do that for every patient. But here in the whole Jefferson system, as of today, I think we only have one patient in the hospital with clearly diagnosed disease, yet we're going through our personal protective equipment like wildfire, because, you know, everybody who's coughing and sneezing is, you know, now a COVID case, and so we're going to run out of these supplies. So based on both Pennsylvania Department of Health, the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, the CDC, you know, we've liberalized the guidelines to balance the what we think about protection versus what's going to be truly available. I think, with that long-winded answer, I still think that this is likely to be an aerosol kind of infection, much like any other coronavirus or respiratory infection. We think that the droplets from sneezes and coughs are probably the major means of transmission.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. Our next question is from Mike Brumer.
Hi. If a person thinks that they are symptomatic, what should they do? Where should they go for testing?
Well, that's the challenge. I can only speak for Philadelphia. Every area is trying to solve this. You know, we've set up testing sites at Jefferson. I'm sure there are sites for all the other healthcare providers. What we're trying to do is do this sort of drive-through, and we have that set up here, and I think pretty much everybody else does as well. And so the key is that we have to try and utilize the best judgment of clinicians to order the testing. If we set up walk-in sites for everybody who feels they might have it, whether it be with true symptoms or not, then it would overwhelm our system. So right now these are all by provider orders. We kind of have a list of priorities of people that we ought to test. Remember, 80 to 85% of people who get this, so if you're a young, otherwise healthy person, you develop these kinds of symptoms, you're probably just better off, maybe you want to contact your physician, but home quarantine, because chances are you're going to get something that looks like the cold and you're going to get over it. Knowing that you have it won't change that recommendation. You're still going to stay home and self-quarantine. We're not going to hospitalize you just because you have COVID. We're only going to hospitalize people when they're sick. So that's the dilemma we're kind of facing right now. We're still at a point where we have kind of limited testing capability. So we want to test those who are clearly sick. So hence people hospitalized, people at high risk for developing illness. So these are kind of our priorities right now. We're not testing, no matter what you read about, famous people who have had contact with a known COVID case. We do not recommend testing asymptomatic people because we're not sure what the test means. If you really have no symptoms, then if we do this test and we don't find virus, doesn't mean that you can't get it within that 14-day period. And so I think it's a false sense of security that you test negative. We know that the viral load of people increases pretty rapidly once symptoms develop. So for all of those reasons, we're not recommending asymptomatic people be tested. I don't know what that's all about. It makes no sense.
Well, if you think you have symptoms,
symptoms are different.
Who would you call in Philadelphia, for example?
Your physician, and they can guide you about whether they think testing is necessary.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right, our next question is from Richard May.
Good afternoon, Dr. Zerlo. From what I have heard, there's no certainty of acquired immunity from being infected with COVID-19. What challenges does this present, and does it mean we could have a bimodal or a multimodal experience with this virus?
It's possible, but I bet not. I'm just giving you my own opinion. I have a feeling when people develop this infection, they will develop some degree of immunity. whether that is a long-lasting immunity or more limited. Remember, a lot of respiratory viruses, like these coronaviruses, they mutate quickly. But beyond that, for whatever reason, people don't develop long-term immunity after infection. Hence, you know, people get common colds all the time. Since we don't know in most people with each episode of their common cold what the cause is, it's difficult to answer that, but my guess is that people will develop some degree of immunity and at least in the near term won't be susceptible. We know in the Chinese experience, for example, that they've taken patients who've gotten the infection proven, they're over it, and they do a plasmapheresis. They take their serum and then they infuse it into people with serious disease, and we know that that improves the clinical course of those people. And that's not a new phenomenon. So-called passive immunization has been done for a long, long time. We're not kind of ready yet in this country to begin that, but it's on my mind. But I don't know where we stand. So we don't know what the long-term immunity will be. We're just getting into serologic testing now.
Thank you very much.
All right. Anybody else has any questions? Hit star 5.
John, I'll jump in again. As opposed to trying to work on a vaccine, which I'm sure everybody's going to work on anyway, how about what they've done in the world of cancer with immuno-oncology? What about, ginning up your own T cells to attack this virus?
I don't know, Peter, honestly. I don't know about that kind of line of investigation. It could have some value, but I think that's much more speculative than the more common approaches. So that's kind of the way I'd see it. I think the most urgent thing would be getting an effective treatment. Imagine if we had a known effective treatment, much like, again, look at the Tamiflu experience. We have Tamiflu available, so boom. You get symptoms to suggest COVID. Boom. You go get tested because everybody's concerned about COVID. Boom. You get a test back within 4 hours, which is where we're aiming toward. And boom, here's your remdesivir course. You're going to take 5 days of it, and we know that that will reduce the chances of you getting really sick, hospitalized, and so forth and so on. That's where we'd like to be at some point in the near future. So if we had effective treatment, that would be great.
Okay. Our next question is from Daniel. Go ahead, Daniel.
Hey, as a layperson who, you know, I'm kind of young and healthy, and, you know, maybe I get sick and I'm willing to just kind of self-quarantine and have some bad flu symptoms, what would be the things that I should look for where this is crossing from, hey, I got a bad flu and I just got to suck it up, to, hey, you really probably might need to actually call someone and look for help, whether that's breathing trouble or the other question is, if you do have access to a pulse oximeter and can track, oxygen levels, where are the red lines where it should go from, now this sucks, to, hey, I need to seek real attention?
I think if you become short of breath, that's probably the most logical thing that people would say. You know, if you really start being short of breath, that's when we'd say, yeah, this is getting bad. If you can measure your pulse oximeter, great. You know, you start getting consistently below 95, you know, without, if you have no underlying lung disease, you know, that would also kind of confirm, yeah, there's something not quite right here.
Thank you. That's exactly what I wanted to know. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. Our next question is from Rick. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, Nick Hammersley. Oh. If you were taking a drug for Parkinson's disease called Azilect, is there any reason to be thinking about adverse effect for something you might take for pneumonia and or COVID?
Not that I know of. Offhand, I don't know. frankly.
Okay.
You've seen in the papers that people are talking about ACE2 inhibitors, lisinopril, for example, enalapril. There's some reason or a theoretical reason to think that this could enhance virus or virus replication or something, or viral entry into lung cells. That's really speculative, because one of the concerns that people have raised was that hypertension by itself seems to be a small risk factor. Why would high blood pressure have anything to do with worsening of a respiratory virus? So this is a theory out there, but a lot of people have spoken about this. There's no data at all or no real clinical evidence to suggest that we should tell everybody to stop taking their lisinopril or enalapril or other ACE inhibitor. So that's in the news right now, and I don't think we have any answer about that. I can't speak to any other drugs, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. There don't seem to be any other questions. So, John, many thanks for your time, and best of luck. I know you've got a hard slog in front of you, but thanks very much for spending this time with us. Take care. Happy to help.
Happy to help, Peter.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Goodbye, everybody.